How are you all today?
Fine. Good.
And God bless you. I don't know whether or not I'm going to be able to give you the fine detail that minister is looking for, because he's actually covered quite a bit of it. I will tell you, though, what I have gleaned from my experience going every day. And let me start, first of all, explaining to you why I've even gone. One of the reasons why I have been there every day is because, thank you, is because each of us has a vested interest in what has taken place in the city of Oakland on January the 1st. Clearly, the family of Oscar Grant have a vested interest for their immediate loved one. And those who are related or who are family friends, they have a vested interest. As a physician, as a behavioral scientist who is concerned about the community that we live in, I have an interest. But as a community leader, as is the case with so many of us who are here, the reason why we're there and the reason why I'm in that courtroom is because one day Joan Hurst is going to be successful and there's going to be some compensation to the family of Oscar Grant, the Skrilla. There will be money. And there will be a readiness on the part of Bart and on the part of BART police officers, the city of Oakland, to try to close the books and say that the matter has been settled. And in reality, we have not even seen the tip of the iceberg here. What we're looking at as the trial unfolds is evidence that this is not only a deep-seated problem, but it's a problem that has festered long enough that it's about to erupt within our respective communities on a broader level. There will be more Oscar Grants. And some of us who are parents and relatives of young men of color know already the fear that we live with that it might be our child next, or it was our child before, and we were not compensated, and we're still grieving. And one of the things that I'm particularly pleased with in this case is the fact that the family of Oscar Grant has been stellar in the manner in which they have conducted themselves in advocating for the loss of their loved one. Not only have they advocated for him, but they have advocated for the community. Many, many times we have witnessed Uncle Bobby and Sister Wanda, Reverend Wanda, go to the mic and speak to the greater good issue. And one of the reasons why I'm in the courtroom is because the greater good issue will be lost if someone isn't listening to the detail of what happened. Now, one of the things I want to say to you is that when this case first started, and understandably, the family of Oscar Grant clearly was not in a position and had no desire to talk about the shortcomings of their loved one or the shortcomings of any of the young men on the platform. We know that no one is perfect. And yet, because of the egregious nature of what took place, we were all willing to stand behind this family, whether he was perfect, kind of perfect, almost perfect, had warts, didn't have warts. We were willing to stand behind him on blind faith. So I want to report to you that based on what I have heard in the courtroom, we weren't unwise. And I'm glad that it has been proven that Oscar wasn't perfect. Oscar was like any one of our sons or daughters. He was a young man who was making his way to a higher level of maturity, to a more responsible level of behavior. But there was nothing, absolutely nothing about his conduct that night. There was nothing about his conduct on the train, off the train. There was nothing that occurred on the train, off the train, by any of the young men who were with Oscar that rose to the level that any of us would be profoundly embarrassed by. I want you to hear me real clearly. And that's important for you to know, because as a community, we have to be willing to accept that these are not perfect young men. And the flaws that they had were the flaws that society has helped to create within them. We have witnessed in the courtroom proof that there was racial profiling from the very beginning. The first witness who came to the stand, Dennis Zafiratos, was a white gentleman who was on the train at around 2 o'clock in the morning with his wife and his two children, who already had a sense of anxiety about being in a crowd. And he racially profiled a turmoil that was going on, a disturbance, some jostling about in an overly crowded train that made him feel uncomfortable enough to pick up his children and hold them tightly so that they wouldn't get injured inadvertently. He was the one who pushed the panic button. And I have a couple of adjectives that I have come to conclude about him as I listened to his testimony. Was hypersensitive. He was paranoid. He was precipitous. He was overreactive. He was hypervigilant. What do I mean by that? He said that he was on a train, he was watching it, and this happened, and then that happened, and they were fighting like this, and at the same time, he was saying it was so crowded that they were like sardines. Well, I don't know if you're like sardines and you have time to do all of that. It flies in the face of truth. He was a citizen cop, and he was a self-appointed citizen cop. He decided that he had to take matters in his own hand, pick up his children, move to another train, close the door, and stand guard at the gate so that none of them could get into the car that he moved to. And the them, quoting his words in his testimony, the them were black folks. And there was a white gentleman on the train by the name of Horowitz, Dennis Horowitz, who had been in Santa Rita, who knew Oscar Grant, who gave testimony that, I like Oscar. Oscar treated me well when we did some time together. He was a really nice guy. I'm more afraid of the police and law enforcement and the criminal justice system than I am, or than I was Oscar, or than I am of anyone in Oscar's family or in the community. I'm more afraid of you than him. Oscar was good to me. That was his testimony. That didn't come out in the paper.
That's right.
And what this citizen cop self-appointed tried to do was give the impression that he allowed this white guy to come into the car that he moved to protect him and his white son and his half-white, half-Hispanic wife, to protect them from those black guys in the other car. That's what he said. That was his testimony. Anyone else there? Jack, you were there. Is that essentially what he said?
Yeah, and the young man you're talking about that said he was cool with Oscar is a man he allegedly had a fight with.
That's right. That's right. And this is, I mean, and so you can already see that what happened was this first witness who pushed the panic button that caused all of the problem in the first place was racially profiling African Americans and young men of color, various hues of color. But he called them blacks. That was his testimony. Dennis Horowitz, I've already told you about him. He came in as a hostile witness, didn't want to testify because he said he didn't know anything, he wasn't fighting with Oscar, he didn't have any problems with Oscar. The third witness, already know about Karina Vargas, who had her videotape. I want you to know, and you should know this about this young woman, she was spontaneous. She was sitting on the train, minding her business, but she was vigilant. You know, you see those community watch posters in various neighborhoods that let you know that your neighbors are watching out for you. They've got your back. Well, this sister had our back. She had the back of Oscar and his friends. She was spontaneous. She was courageous. She was instinctive. She sensed that something was not right, and she peered at it, got her camera ready. She was bold, and she was unapologetic. When people tried to tell her, get out of the way so the door could close, she kept saying to them, but that's not right. Her activism was alive and well within her. And when she saw that the situation was intensifying, she got off the train with camera in hand, and she went toward the conflict. She didn't jump on the train and hide. She got off the train and moved toward the conflict so that she could get a better taping of what was going on with disregard for her own safety. That's someone we should one day celebrate. Conscientious, and yet she was impartial. She was balanced. She was fair. She gave the officers the due that there was some confusion. But she also was very clear about what she witnessed, and she had integrity. She didn't ask for money for her videotape. Then there was the coroner who came on to give testimony, Dr. Thomas Rogers. And I know Tom from many, many years ago because I used to do second opinion autopsies with him. And Tom is a somewhat passive, dispassionate guy. He's just the facts, man, just the facts. We like to say among physicians that pathologists are people who don't have a whole lot of personality. They like dealing with the dead because the dead don't talk back at you. You don't have to have a conversation with them. And in fact, the district attorney tried to ask him whether or not it was necessary or considered appropriate to try to do CPR on Oscar. But he didn't ask it that way. He said, "Now, doctor, you did the autopsy on this gentleman. And can you tell us what the trajectory was of the bullet?" And Dr. Rogers said, it went in at about 30 degrees toward the head and about 40 degrees angled at the spine. And he said, "Well, officer, if that's the case, then that would have gone through the hilum of the chest. Is that correct?" "Yes, it is." "Aren't there some large blood vessels in that region?" "Yes, there are." "And if those blood vessels had been compromised in some way, isn't it a fact that that would probably have been a deadly wound?" "Yes, it usually is." And so, point of fact, doctor, CPR is probably not anything that would have been of any benefit to him. Is that fair to say, officer? Is that fair to say, doctor?" And he said, "More or less." Now, that was real significant. Because what the district attorney was trying to do was get some testimony on the record that would suggest that Meserly, Peroni, and all of the other officers who did nothing other than shake Oscar, look at him, flip him, and then step back, that behavior was appropriate, when in fact it wasn't. And we have already argued before Bart, and in fact one of the district attorneys, one of the defense counsel's own witnesses, who was a passenger on the train, who was also a paramedic of some age 10 years, who gave testimony that she tried to tailor to the benefit of Mr. Meserly, had to admit herself that nobody at the scene was doing what they were supposed to do in response to the injury. And so the whole question of whether or not some effort to resuscitate Mr. Grant was appropriate, not appropriate, came into question. And the district attorney was approached by me at the break around the question of whether or not that was going to be left open-ended. Because as it was left, the coroner said it probably would not have been any benefit. Now, we know we have a judge listening to this case, and we know that the judge has the potential for reducing the charges. I'm not sure whether or not, I'm sure that if something comes out of the testimony suggesting that this was premeditated, that there was some anger among the officers that was that framed their state of mind before they even arrived at the Fruitvale Bar Station. If some testimony like that comes up, there is the potential for this being upgraded to a first degree. As it stands, it's just a murder, probably second degree. And the question is, will it be reduced at this point to a manslaughter, as in involuntary? The testimony that came in that has not been refuted is testimony that suggests that Messerly, immediately after shooting, had a dumbfounded look on his face, reached for his head as if to say, oh my God, what did I do? That testimony is unrefuted and it's powerful testimony, and it's come in from both sides of witnesses. And so strategically, the question that the district attorney will have to examine is, do I leave that unchallenged, waiting for the trial? Or do I attempt to address that now? And the answer to that is a matter of how does the judge appear to be moving along in this case? Because if the judge is a judge who likes police officers and wants to be police officer friendly, he might be satisfied with just that movement, that motion, to give him the grounds to reduce this to an involuntary manslaughter. And so next week, we're still working with the district attorney to determine whether or not he should bring in some testimony about what the appropriate conduct should have been by the police officers, particularly Messerly, in light of the fact that he, accidentally did this. And if you accidentally do something like that, what would be the natural response of any human being? Oh my God, you dropped to your knees. Oh my God, look what I've done. And if you are a trained first responder, which all law enforcement officers are, you begin CPR. And he didn't do that. None of them did that. And one of Messerly's own witnesses confirmed that it should have been done. Jamil Dewar is the 16-year-old young man who was on the platform with Oscar. And I had an opportunity to work with Jamil and a couple of the other young men. And he's a fine young man. He's a typical 16-year-old kid who still has a strong sense of self-esteem, which, as each of us know, is under attack in our young brothers of color. And so when he got on the stand, without the benefit of having been prepared by Mr. Burris or any other lawyer, he did very well. I'm going to give you the words I found for him. He was spontaneous, he was youthful, he was confident, he was self-assured, he was unapologetic, he was nice. Was he nice? He was a nice young man. He was also typical, in the sense that he profiled like the average young brother who we see on the street. And he was polite. But he still had strong self-esteem. It seemed present. And he verbally had an interaction with Michael Raines, attorney for Messerly, in which he held his own around the use of the word nigger versus nigga. Now, I don't think they printed this in the paper, but it's a subtle distinction. And I have to tell you, as an African-American mother of three and a son who's 21, and one who was a real fan of Tupac and some of the other hip-hop artists, to hear this young brother to distinguish in the courtroom on the stand the difference between the two, nigger versus nigga. And to say it in a matter-of-fact sort of way, it said to me that I myself don't have the level of cultural competence to understand that generation. Okay? And if I don't get it as a black woman, which of them, I understand they don't get it. Okay? Now, does it mean that it's okay by my standard? Heck no. You know, I mean, come on. Do you really have to use the N word? Can we just drop the N? No. Whatever the reason is that they feel the need to do that, it is not deadly. It's not harmful to others, except from a sociologic standpoint. And so what he explained it intellectually on the stand with the district attorney, and it took some maturity and some strong self-esteem to do that. And he didn't have to cuss to make that happen. And once again, I said he was not prepared by any professional. Tommy Cross was the young man who's a college student at San Francisco State College. And he had a videotape that he took at the time of the trial, at the time of the incident. And he was on the train and left and at the Bayfair station. I don't know whether he got off voluntarily. I think he got off voluntarily. He got off voluntarily and reported. No.
He was looking at it.
He was looking at it, and one of the BART officers at the Bayfair station asked him if he could see it. And I'm going to give you the words that I came up with. This young man, he was trusting. African American. Trusting, innocent bystander. He was disturbed by what he experienced. He was quiet. He was cerebral. You could see this is a student, a college student. He was naive, but he was compliant. And what he did was he complied with the officer's request. Give me your chip. Do you mind if I make a copy? Can I download it? They couldn't download it. Well, then you give me the chip, and I'll give it back to you. And he trusted them, gave it to them, and they never gave it back. Okay? Now, this is one of our brothers who's in college, who tried to assimilate and do it the way they want us to do it, tried to comply, and he got duped. And he felt badly that he got duped. But he got on the stand, he gave his testimony, and after his testimony, which was very straightforward and did not contradict any of the other videos, nor did it necessarily add any light to the other videos. He got off the stand, and I asked him whether or not he had had any debriefing, post-traumatic stress counseling, and the answer was no, but that he needed some. And so this is yet another young brother, another victim of that experience, who came forward courageously and is suffering. He's been suffering since January, and but for him giving testimony and us having a presence in the courtroom where we came to him and said, thank you for your courage. Commend you for what you did. We know it wasn't easy for you. Are you okay? Why are we there at 6 o'clock in the morning? Because that's what we need to be there for. By the way, he's getting counseling now. Okay. Daniel Liu, I talked about the young man who didn't ask for any money for his tapes, and Karina Vargas, who didn't ask him any money for hers. There was a witness for Mr. I think he came in as a witness for the defense, Daniel Liu, whose tape was sold to Channel 2 for $1,000. And that came out in court. And he was a very reticent witness. And he was Asian. And he was reticent in a way where we were trying to figure out, is this a cultural reticence? Why is he kind of careful in the language that he uses to answer the questions? I think we concluded that he was trying to be neutral. But ultimately, on cross-examination, he came forward with the concession that he thought that there was excessive force. And I'm sharing that with you because these are all the witnesses who are coming in, and in spite of who called them and what their predisposition might have been coming to the stand, they're all coming clean with facts that help us to get victory for Oscar Grant. Aletha Rogers, this is the young woman who's the paramedic. And she came in and she tried very hard to give testimony that would be helpful to law enforcement. And she was the one who said, well, I was just watching carefully until, you know, I was on the BART train and I had a seat where I could see everything. And it seemed like they weren't doing what they were told to do, and the officers were yelling for them to sit down. And then I saw this one guy who looked like a military guy. I saw him knee Oscar Grant. And when she said that, the district attorney, Dave Stein, who is phenomenal, well-prepared, who has done a tremendous job thus far, David Stein took his time, and he pulled up the proper video, and he slowed it down, and captured the frame in which the kneeing took place. And you can see when the knee took place, Oscar's head went back and went down. And when he framed it out and said, was this what you saw? Does this accurately depict what you said you saw when you were sitting on the train? And she said, yes, that's it. And I don't know if the rest of you saw it, but the judge said, play that again. Play that again. They rewound it, played it again. The judge frowned, picked up his pen, and started writing. I think each of us just kind of nudged each other with a sense of reassurance that the judge was watching carefully and paying attention to these critical points in the testimony. She also gave testimony that the officers were getting rough, that they were getting rough with the dreadlocked guy. One of the young men who was on the train had dreadlocks, and the testimony that came in proved that there was excessive force, not just toward Oscar, but toward several of the young men, one of them having dreadlocks. The next witness that the defense put on was Wolfenden, the officer who was the partner to Johannes Messerly. And this testimony was pretty powerful because he was very composed. He was the typical seasoned 8-10-year veteran of law enforcement who took the stand and behaved in such a way that the Joe Blow public would be impressed. He said, for example, when he was asked, did you hear the gunshot? He said, no, I heard a loud noise. And he heard a loud noise, not a gunshot? No, I heard a loud noise. What did you think the loud noise was? I thought it was a loud taser. And the testimony that came in suggested that after he heard this noise, according to him, he at first didn't know that anyone was shot, and that he kind of picked it up along the way, and you're watching me saying, well, what did he say? He was as vague when he gave his testimony about what that sound meant to him and the fact that someone had been shot, as I am telling you the story. And so the judge said, well, when you heard this and you learned that somebody was shot, why didn't you draw your weapon? Right. I mean, you were law enforcement, but did you draw your weapon? No. Well, why didn't you draw your weapon? Well, I figured the situation was under control. One officer after another was asked, did you draw your weapon when you heard a gunshot? In spite of the fact you felt that there was a near riot going on, and you felt that you were in great danger. Each of these officers had a red button that they could have pushed as a panic button, saying, open the airway so that you hear my voice, and everybody who is on duty for BART will hear my voice at the same time. They all have the access to that same button, and all they had to do was push it for 3 seconds. And if they did, any one of them could have said, we need backup. Wolfman said they needed 20 to 30 more officers, but he never pushed his button. Domenici said we needed 20 to 30 more officers. Did she say 100? She said 100. She never pushed her button. I think Peroni hasn't been asked the question yet. He's still early in his testimony. But the contradiction of how bad the situation was on the platform is what the officers themselves are beginning to be impeached on. Every one of the officers have been questioned around the issue of how many people made up a crowd. How many people made up this dangerous crowd that were coming at us posing a deadly threat for which we feared for our lives, and this being the worst situation or the near worst situation we've ever been in as law enforcement officers. And the district attorney was able to get them each to admit that the crowd constituted 4 people.
Wow.
And some who said, oh, there were more, the district attorney was very clever and careful in getting them to be precise. Oh, was it more than 10? Was it 30? I don't remember exactly. Well, where were they exactly? And they were led to a point where they tried to give precise detail. Well, on the right there was this, and on the left there was that, and there were 3 or 4, and then there was a crowd over here, and he allowed them to just go and get a testimony. And he very carefully went to the clerk and picked up the videotape, put it in the computer, loaded it up, and said, now, officer, I want you to watch the videotape and tell us.
When
you see what you give in testimony. And on each and every occasion, they were impeached. It couldn't be found. I think one of the most glaring and offensive testimonies that came in regarding this was from Officer Domenici, the woman, who said that she had to run and navigate in between a crowd of, nearly 30 people? And she was just trying to navigate around them. And the district attorney pulled up the surveillance tape that captured the platform from a long distance. And in the videotape, you can see her running onto the platform toward her partner. Was there one person who walked by? I'm trying to help her. But the crowd of 100 wasn't there. And even though it wasn't there, she said, well, they were there.
Ooh.
Well, they were there. So he said, well, let's go back. Well, let's go back. Wound the tape and gave an opportunity to find it again. And you stop me where you see it.
Okay.
She stopped him where it wasn't and said, there it is. Who are you going to believe, me or your lying eyes? She dared to test the visibility of what we saw as opposed to what she claimed was present. Even in the face of it not being present, the judge just went, start crying again. And finally, this is sum up, because I know that we want to move on. I want to tell you that all of the officers who testified, except for Domenici and Peroni, at least made an effort at being professional. And it could be because they were seasoned. But Domenici got on the stand, and it was clear she had an axe to grind. She was mad. She was angry. She was rambling. She was talking so fast. The judge had to slow her down. Michael Raines had to slow her down. She was resentful. She was resentful around the issue of having been called names, She particularly didn't like the fact that they were told, she was told, and her partner was told that the BART police officers weren't. And that they were basically just security guards, and they all went, no, shh. And they said that they didn't have to, she went into the colloquy and the body language of being pissed off. Okay? And we could see her having a flashback to where she was that night. She told us that when she arrived on the scene, the young men were standing, and that she had to make them sit down. And even though there's an acknowledgement that there was no probable cause to be fearful of them, that they weren't doing anything criminal when they were first witnessed on the platform, there was no call that went out from dispatch suggesting that there was a weapon, there was no behavior on their part that would cause them to be fearful of their lives or their safety, instead of allowing them to sit on a bench as citizens who were being questioned, she told them to sit on the ground. And I mention that to you because it speaks to the concerns that we as parents have in the community. To the extent that our young brothers are being forced to exist in society with lesser self-esteem, lesser self-esteem, to the extent that they are being told that they can be treated like animals, they're not entitled to respect, they're not entitled to courtesy, that they can be talked to any old way. These young men, including Oscar Grant, said, hell no, not on my watch. And I want you to say those words. They said the words of their generation. And Uncle Bobby, I want to say to you that having been at the trial, when I say that these young men were not perfect, and they had warts just like all of us have warts. All of us have a point at which we feel violated. And as adults, we're able to appreciate that. It's very difficult for us to appreciate the boundaries for young adults. It's very tempting for us as parents to belittle the needs of teenagers or young adults. You didn't have them long enough. We blow them off. Okay? Some of us do. Society has been blowing off the needs of these young folks since they were old enough to express their needs. And we have just been telling them, like Reginald Miles, who was here, wonderful guy. But what did he tell us? He said, you tell your children to just shut up. Just obey. Just do this. Just do that. If the police stop you, just this, just that. And our children are saying, not on my watch. I'm not going to wait until I'm 60 to be a man. I'm not going to wait until I'm 30. I'm not going to wait until I have a college degree and I'm wearing a three-piece suit and I have an attaché case. I'm a human being now, and I want to be treated like a human being. And I firmly believe that is what happened that night. These young men were involved in a pushing and shoving incident on the train that was crowded amongst other people who had all been drinking, or many of them had been drinking because it was New Year's Eve. And they weren't in a car putting others at risk. They were on a train trying to do right. And the pushing and shoving is something that you expect. They didn't expect to be profiled and targeted and hauled out like animals and thrown in a corner and told to sit on the ground as if they didn't have rights. And I got to tell you, I'm proud of them. And the testimony is coming in that supports that this is what happened. And I want to encourage each of you to understand that these were not squeaky clean choir boy young men. They were young men growing into manhood. They were young men who had made some mistakes, but were working hard with the support of their families and of their community to be better young men. And any of us who would try to judge them would be misjudging them, because the standards of the community try to put them down. And if we don't take this case and try to make a community statement for all brothers of color who are similarly situated, we will have missed an opportunity that may not come around again. I think these young men were as squeaky clean as we could hope for. And we should not want to wait until another young brother of color gets targeted, where we have to go through this process again. And this is the reason why I want to celebrate the Grant family for sharing the platform of this protest, not only about their loved one who was lost, but the loved ones who have already been lost and who will still be lost if we don't look at the bigger picture. Okay? Thank you.
Thank you. You are being.